Hello, this is the May edition of The Work Show here on WGXC Hands-On Radio at 90.7 FM out of Hudson, Catskill, and Acre, New York. Today we decided to do something a little different and interviewed the author and social critic Matthew Klickstein while driving around the area. Matt, who recently published the definitive oral history of Nickelodeon, has been traveling the country working on his next book and has spent the last month in our home. We talked about work ethics, creativity, and some of the shifts affecting our culture of late.
Stone, the guys, you know, did South Park and Book of Mormon. They talk about that a lot, how they can't even imagine how someone without a deadline would be able to get any work done, that they have to have a really stringent deadline. It's one of the reasons why they produce South Park the way they do, where they create it in a 6-day period so that, you know, it also keeps it timely, but part of it is, you know, in that rigorous framework, it forces them to work in a way where they're going to really produce their best stuff, they feel.
Yeah.
So it varies for me. I mean, I certainly do a lot of writing, as I'm sure you do, or other even like little film projects and stuff that, you know, just for fun and for myself. And sometimes it's stuff I sell, and sometimes it's stuff that goes nowhere. So I can do a little bit of both. But deadlines definitely can help. I've never missed a deadline. In fact, when I was working on the Nickelodeon book, truth be told, they wanted to give me only 3 months in the beginning. I had to beg for six, and even six was scant at best. In fact, I talked to two other people who had done some pretty big oral histories, including Legs McNeil, who you might be familiar with. Yeah. He did the punk one, and he called it downright criminal. And I also talked to a guy named Mark Yarm, who also used to do a lot of stuff for Spin and Blender and whatnot, and he did the grunge oral history. And he said, you know, the first thing you got to do is ask for a longer deadline.
because you need time just to schedule all of that.
Yeah, I mean, when they first told me 3 months, I was just like, what are you, crazy? Like, I mean, I think originally what they really wanted was more of a simple, to-the-point, matter-of-fact, gossipy, little fun nostalgia book where I talk to 15 or 20 people, the big names, get some, you know, juicy backstories and put this thing together. I mean, originally, also, my word count was extremely low. It was only going to be 70,000 words, including foreword, you know, acknowledgments, dedication, the cast of characters, which alone was, you know, 10 or 20 pages, because I talked to a lot of people and each one had a little bio. I mean, that was really rough. I had to push for even 90,000. I turned in 300,000. We had to cut it down significantly. Yeah, it represents a third of what I actually turned in.
Now, is this the first, had you worked on something of this length before?
Sort of. It's my first quote-unquote big book, as far as with a major publisher, but I had written numerous books in the past, both published and unpublished, but the ones that were published were all by very, very small, extremely limited publishers. And one I actually self-published when I was the summer between my freshman sophomore year of college. That was the first book of mine that was quote-unquote published. That was before even Amazon really took off and whatnot. So I got a couple grants. I got some money from some friends. A buddy of mine is an amazing artist, and he did a fantastic cover design, which I think really helped a lot. And I was in LA at the time, so I was able to just sort of spread it around some little bookstores there on consignment.
What was the book?
It was called, this book is called Counter. I actually used a pseudonym, Muna Noman. Muna from a book called Sign of the Chrysanthemum, meaning no name. And Noman being, of course, the name that Odysseus gives to the Cyclops. Who's there? Who stabbed my eye? Noman. Noman did it. And it was a polemic, sort of farcical book, very, very written by someone who was 18. And was kind of learning a lot and kind of realizing all the contradictions of the world and pop culture and how difficult it is to be an artist, quote-unquote, and some of the hypocrisies of politics. And it definitely reads like someone who is an angry young man. But, I was pretty proud of some of the elements that I brought to it. I did some things that I found later, after I read Ulysses, coincidentally, that he did, that I did before I read that he did that. Like, just certain things as far as, it was written in different people's perspectives, and there were scenes where when they were all together, I would actually cut off in mid-sentence, and then it would go to the next person. So it was literally almost, if it were a film, it would be quick cutting to each person's perspective. And, I thought that was a pretty clever thing to come up with, you know, as a younger person on my own. And then I saw that he did the same kind of thing in Ulysses, and a few other little fun, you know, playful moments with the form. One of the characters is, the whole time her story is told in third person, but then at the end, right at the end, she kind of takes control of her situation, and suddenly it's in first person. Uh-huh. And not to be too arrogant, I think that I was pretty clever in coming up with little playful ways of messing with the form like that. So that kind of stuff I'm proud of. The actual writing, the actual content is definitely very cliche and angry young man.
Had you been writing for ever?
I've always written. Yeah, I actually, I wrote my first full novel when I was 13. It was a science fiction novel. It was about 350 pages. we actually had a, my mom had a distant relative who used to work at Simon & Schuster, and we tried to send it over there through the auspices of him, but unfortunately, you know, of course, it was a giant mess, that book, so they rejected it. Although I have to say, to this day, I've always been a little disappointed, even surprised, that no one at least had the foresight to be like, wow, that's still kind of impressive that a 13-year-old wrote a 350-page novel. And it dealt with some pretty sophisticated subject matter. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a young adult novel. It was a real book, and I definitely incorporated a lot, you know, I was into a lot of science fiction at the time. And I always kind of wondered why no one, because we sent it to a couple other little places, but...
Yeah, no, whoever wrote the rejection letter must have felt...
Yeah, it was clear he was being a little patronizing, which I understand, but I don't know. It just, I have always wondered why no one bothered to kind of step and be like, well, this isn't good, but man, if we work with you a little bit, you know, maybe by the time you're 16 or something, you could really do something. And thereafter, I wrote another novel the next summer, which was extremely ambitious and sophisticated. It was a political, satire, again, very much in line with Aldous Huxley and George Orwell. I was really into those kinds of books, and Jonathan Swift. I incorporated a lot of what I'd been learning the year before in an advanced placement European history class. I echoed basically what would happen if there was a certain kind of breakdown between the racial and class structure in the country, and how that would affect the rest of the world, and each chapter sort of 5 years later type of a thing. And, you know, again, for at this point, 14 or 15-year-old kid to be writing that kind of thing, I was, again, kind of surprised that no one bothered to just be like, well, you know, obviously this isn't good. You're just a young kid, but clearly there's something going on. Or help.
What was your, nuts and bolts, what was your methodology at that point? Were you working on a computer then, or a typewriter, or anything?
I was working on a computer, which has changed a lot. Now I generally write longhand, and then I type it up, both because I find that there's less distraction that way. I can really just sit there. It's the, you know, pad of paper and myself. Sometimes sitting in a coffee shop, sometimes, you know, sitting in a park.
And that forces a revision, too.
That's the big reason why. I literally have to rewrite everything. A lot of times, because what I really love doing when I'm writing is just letting it flow. And not to get too crude here, it becomes almost orgasmic. It's just coming out. I mean, that's when I know I've really got something going, where it's almost like sneezing or throwing up, or, yeah, the sexual act, really. So I just sort of spit it up all over the page. Generally, it's almost unreadable, but there it all is, all the characters, all the dialogue, that kind of thing. And then I'll wait a couple weeks and then type it up, and it's almost like I'm a secretary for someone else, and I'm really able to kill my darlings. And then I take that draft, I wait another couple of weeks, and I go back and actually do like a real edit. And then from there, it's usually just a couple more polishes before I'm able to do something with it. Obviously, with journalism work, I can't work that way. I have to go a lot faster, especially if I'm working on a daily or something like that, or I have a lot of deadlines, or I'm doing a lot of work all at once. Then I tend to work just right on the computer. So it can vary.
And are you working pretty much daily, or are there certain hours that work better than that? Do you have a daily regimen that you follow?
I need to keep it really unstructured. I think it would sort of drive me crazy if I structured it like that. I know a lot of people need to do that. I need sort of the opposite. I sort of flourish under a chaotic environment. Again, you know, that's why deadlines can work for me, because it's something a lot of times different than my normal structure, which is none. And I really like the idea that I can work sometimes, you know, 2 a.m. at a party I might be at. I'll just, like, go out on the balcony and write if I'm inspired, or, you know, at a coffee shop the next day, or whatever it might be. There are times when, if I'm working on a longer project, like, let's say, a full-length screenplay or a longer book or something like that, where I find creating my own little special structure does engender a kind of working regimen that can work. Like, I'll go to the same place and listen to the same music, preferably during the same hours, and sometimes that can be really helpful. But I tend to get bored after a while. I've been lucky enough where I have had staffing posts at different newspapers and publications, and it can be really fun at first, and I kind of miss having an office and being part of a team. But yeah, generally after about 6 months or longer, I start getting bored and kind of want to go back to writing whenever I want. And I do generally write probably almost every day. It's just something I do. It's something I've always done. I love it. It's what I do when I'm nervous. It's what I do when I'm scared or angry. I find it's really therapeutic for me. I've really never experienced writer's block. In fact,
I've never known that.
I couldn't even really imagine what that's like.
How has money worked into it over all this time?
It's varied greatly. I've been lucky enough where I've been able to 90% of the time make a living with my writing pretty much since college. Granted, my expenses are extremely low. I don't have a car. I don't have medical insurance, which is probably not the greatest thing, especially these days with Obamacare, and, you know, I'm going to get fined for it now or whatever. I don't have kids. I don't really have any real responsibilities outside of myself, so I'm able to live on almost nothing. So that makes it a little bit easier. I mean, if I had a car, if I had kids, if I had a family, if my student loans were much higher and I didn't get certain grants and things, I probably would have had a little bit more trouble living off of just my writing. But for the most part, it's been just that. I haven't had too many other kinds of jobs since graduating college. And even when I have, it's been very small little, like, you know, I did like seasonal work at a garden club when I was in Portland a few years ago. It was literally for just a few weeks or little moments like that. But I'd say it's probably been 3 or 4 times. Generally, it's writing. So I think it's a collusion of my lifestyle allows me to live very cheaply, and I'm able to generally make enough money that way. There's been times where it's been very difficult to do that, and where I have lived extremely hand-to-mouth, especially when I was in L.A. toward the end. I mean, I was very lucky that something would always just come along. And oftentimes it was a big project where I'd get, you know, small 5-figure sum for script work or work on a TV show or whatever it was. You know, nothing major, but enough where I'd be able to pay the bills for another 6 months. And it generally came in the last minute. So I've been
Was there any point of kind of conscious commitment to this life, or did it just kind of happen?
That's a good question.
Or was there something in you that found sustenance? I mean, you talk about the chaos that you were able to pull, you know, the order of writing out of.
You know, I consider it very much like a curse. I was just talking with my mom about this the other day. You know, sometimes I feel like I've pushed myself onto this path, and it's a little too late to move off of it now. And I wonder if I'm really close to breaking that barrier and getting to that point where I could have a family, I could have a house, I could have a car, and be able to live a much more stable life. Or if I'm, you know, if I'm still 10 years away from that, or if that'll never happen. It's really hard to know right now, because I have really good years or really good months, and then I have really bad years or really bad months. Right now, I've been having a really good last couple of years, and I'm in a good situation now. I probably could have a family and a car right now if I really wanted to. And part of that is, you know, it's not just the writing. I'm also a casting producer on a show on Food Network, which is the main way I'm making my money right now. But even that's still, you know, creative, and I'm doing a lot of writing, and I got the job because of my journalism experience. But point of story is, you know, it's a little too late to become a doctor. It's a little too late to become a lawyer. You know, I sometimes wish I had spent a little bit more time and invested a little more time into music and gotten a little bit more into that. And that's something I would like to revisit, but I just don't have the time or the energy or even the money right now to really invest that kind of thing into music. I need to really focus on my writing. This is what I've chosen to do. This is what I want to do. And this is, again, this is like the easiest thing for me. You know, I don't know whether I'm good or bad. It's all subjective. You know, there's no points to be taken. But I know I can get it done. You know, if I had to sit down and create something, or I had to express myself, or if I was part of a team, and what is Matt going to do to contribute to the team? It would be something to do with writing. You know, that's just what I do. So I got to really focus on it. And I feel very dedicated and determined. I have an extremely good work ethic. And I think that's also one of the reasons why I've been able to survive. I mean, I get it done. I work and I make it happen. You know, and I think part of that too is also, again, I don't have a lot of responsibilities. I don't have a kid. I've left girlfriends for my work, and not just because I'm moving on, but also they're just in the way, so to speak. You know, I need to focus on my work right then. So I've definitely sacrificed other parts of my life for my writing, which is another reason too, I think, why I got to stick with it, because I've given up so many other things. I do look back on my life and wonder, gee, like some of my other friends now, what would have happened if I had focused more on family, or if I'd stayed with that one girl or that other girl, or stayed in that one place and really actually focused more on, you know, more domestic things and just became a manager at Walmart or something.
Does that thought process then enter into the writing itself?
Yeah.
Does it get reflected in the choice of subject matter, but also just the gestalt that you bring to it?
Yeah, that's a really good question and a good observation. And it definitely does, especially because a lot of my work is nonfiction and a lot of my work is autobiographical, more or less. Even my work that's not autobiographical is definitely painted by my personal experiences, as I think everyone's writing is, frankly. And so I tend to write a lot about characters who are making similar kinds of decisions. I'm very interested in other artists and filmmakers and writers and the like who have been struggling with that, you know, bicameral lifestyle of how do I keep my domestic lifestyle, my personal lifestyle stable, but also keep focusing on my work and my art. I think a really good example is Robert Crumb, you know, and he's tried to do that through much of his life in some ways, but then, you know, in interviews he'll talk about he really admires people like Pablo Picasso, who were what he called absolute artists, where he was able to basically say, screw the family, I'm just going to focus on my work, and Robert wasn't really able to do that. Robert Crumb did, as much as he was kind of a negligent father in a lot of ways, he did want to kind of give some of his energy to his wife and his daughter, not so much his son. Although recently I met a friend who knows them very well and said that Sophie really went through a very tough time, and Robert Crumb's daughter, and Robert himself even said, I don't know if she's going to be able to make it. And now it sounds like she's doing a lot better, but so I don't know. But I'm very interested in that, and so I tend to focus on characters like that, on stories like that. How do you juggle family and stability and domesticity with being an artist? Especially when you're traveling around and living on the cheap like I do most of the time.
Do you put stuff, does stuff go back to like a central bank account? Or is there something being stored away from it? Or is it a constant push forward?
It's a little bit of both. I used to really keep extremely meticulous tabs on an ever-growing archive of ideas and quotes and thoughts and little snippets that I was really diligent about keeping updated, and I would always keep little chapbooks I still do in my pocket, and I was very dedicated to when I was done with one, I would type it up and it would be part of the archives, or sometimes I'd even make little, you know, self-published little chapbooks, you know, Kinko's or something, give them out to friends and that kind of thing. I haven't really been doing that as much lately. I think I have been focusing a lot more like on the future and on, you know, something that's really going to go forward, as opposed to my own little kind of abstract diary entries and that kind of thing.
This is The Work Show on WGXC 90.7 FM. And today we are interviewing itinerant author Matthew Clixton.
Bridge.
dichotomy there, because my first inclination is to say, and I get really frustrated about this a lot of the time, I think that that kind of insulation, especially when you attain a certain level and you're on kind of a different plane than the rest of the people that you're making movies for and about, or books for and about, of course you're not going to know what's going on. You're going to be like Bush not knowing how to use how to work with the cashier at the grocery store. You're simply leading a very different lifestyle than anybody else. Something else Fassbender talked about at one point in the book also. So you almost are excluded from being able to have that general experience of the zeitgeist, because you are literally on a different plane of existence. At the same time, though, I think it's important to have that vanguard of people, you know, who are a little bit on that other plane, just as it's important to have explorers going to space and explorers going to the bottom of the ocean. I used to say this about Quentin Tarantino, that I thought that one of his great talents and skills and contributions was he was the one willing to watch movies all day long and see all the crap that we wouldn't either want to see or have time to see. And from those, all those movies he watched when he was younger, even, you know, during the Kill Bill years and that kind of thing, he was able to pick and choose little moments and kind of present us with, hey, everybody, here's some of the best moments from American pulp films and from kung fu films and from new Australian films that you've probably never heard of, that you've never seen, but now you can kind of get a little best of omnibus of that. And I used to defend his work that way. It's like, of course it's self-conscious, of course it's very postmodern, but that's kind of what his contribution to society was he explored that vast material in a way that we never would or could. Sometimes in being so esoteric, you are limiting yourself not just to your audience, but also in the perspective that you're trying to promote, you know, because it does, yeah. it becomes too coded, and then it becomes, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? I just, you know, the other day was I have a friend who's kind of been joking with me that now that I'm working for Food Network, he knew me years ago when I was, again, that angry young man, and, you know, he keeps joking, but I think there's a little bit of truth to it too, that I've sort of given up a little bit of my artistic integrity or my street credits, the way he puts it, because now I'm working for Food Network. And but you know, I have to sit there and I have to go, you know, I don't want to just be an artist who's going to be making stuff for myself and for my friends, and, you know, putting stuff up, you know, it's going to be projected in a living room or in a coffee shop. I want everyone to see what I'm doing and to know what I'm doing, and I think that there's a lot more that can be done. As cliche as it sounds, but I think we need to really remember getting into the system and then playing with it there. You know, you can't have a revolution on the outside because no one's going to care or pay attention to it. It'd be like going on strike if you work by yourself. No one cares. You know, you have to do it from the inside, I feel. A great quote, I forget who said it, but, you know, you got to get to the table first and then you can make a mess. And so I want to use this experience of the Food Network and some of the connections I'm making in the Food Network, certainly the money that it's affording me. I mean, because I'm working for the Food Network right now, I'm making probably some of the best money I've ever made in my life, at least over a long period of time. And I'm able to travel and I'm able to meet people and talk to people like you and talk to other people and hear their stories and incorporate that into my work now and know a little bit more about what's going on all over the country. I'm able to spend a lot more time on my own artwork and other writing projects and the like, because I'm not so worried about, you know, paying rent or that kind of thing, because I'm making a stable amount of money right now. So I think it's important to have those connections to a larger gestalt, as we were saying earlier, and not just keeping everything so esoteric and arcane. You know, it's really important. I'm even, you know, just to wrap that up, I'm working on a new book project right now, and I'm really conflicted over the subtitle because I want to use a word that is extremely niche and that only a certain group of people are going to understand. And I keep thinking, well, should I use that word and the people who don't know it are going to be intrigued? Or are they going to just say, oh, this isn't for me? And there's, you know, there's something really difficult about that. You know, which way should I go? And if I don't use that word, you know, the arbiters of that world might say, you know, might be less inclined to say, oh, this guy knows what he's talking about. If I use that word, it's a little code for them, like, oh, this guy, you know, has some credibility here. So, it, you know, that kind of stuff gets really difficult.
And how many projects do you have kind of percolating in the back of the mind? Is there like a general sense of arc too? I mean, do you see projects 5-10 years down the line that you're not ready to reach at this point?
I mean, I have a few screenplays. Most of the screenplays that I've written, I wrote when I was 23. I went through an extremely productive time where I was writing like 2 or 3 screenplays a year for a couple of years in college and a little bit outside of college. And, you know, of the 15 or 20 I wrote, I'd say a good 5 of them are ready to go. And another 5, you know, with a couple of polishes, maybe some collaboration from some other writers, could be ready to go too. And there's a good 1 or 2 that I've had some interest in the past, and one in particular that I have a good friend who's a producer and worked with me on selling the Steven Seagal screenplay that I did write, got produced by Sony Pictures, which, you know, is a terrible film, but I mean, Sony Pictures and Seagal, et cetera, blah, 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 paid the bills for a year. You know, we still talk about that script, and it's been almost 10 years now. It's probably one of the best things I've ever written, so I definitely am thinking of those dream projects like that. And there are other projects that I haven't written yet or I haven't worked on, but that I'd really like to do and hope to be able to do when I have the money and time to do it. Right now, as we speak, I have probably about 2 or 3 different projects in different levels of development that are all pretty close. I mean, any one of them, I could get a phone call while we're talking here by an executive producer or a money man or, you know, some other thing. You know, the book that I'm working on right now, my agent and I are making the final touches to it and on to the proposal, and then he's going to go out with it, and that might sell, and I think it's a good idea, and he thinks it's a good idea, and, you know, it's something that could sell.
Where did your work ethic come from? What was kind of the work world that you grew up in?
Yeah, I think a couple things. The first thing that comes to mind is being Jewish. I'm not religious at all. I wasn't even bar mitzvahed. But blood-wise, I'm like super Jew, both my parents, both grandparents, and on and on and on. So I think heritage and tradition-wise, I've been really pushed in a way that a few of my other Jewish friends were when I was younger. And especially because we were somewhat of the misfits of our little hamlet that I grew up in. I grew up in southern Orange County. And so, you know, everyone was born again Christian. It was very, you know, Saddleback Church. We would have school events at the Saddleback Church, which I still to this day don't understand how that was possible.
Oh, the big Rick Warren thing?
Yeah, exactly. Right, okay. Yeah, no, I have a friend right now who he's one of Rick Warren's main film guys. You know, does a lot of the film work and such. I mean, I'm very intimate in the world of Rick Warren, and I grew up in that scene. So to be Jewish in that world and to be a non-religious Jew, so I was a misfit of the misfits. I didn't even get along very well with some of the other Jewish kids or Jewish families because I was not religious either. But I had a real sense of needing to make my mark and needing to be the best that I could be. So there was a lot of that, and I think a lot of that came from my family, because that's just what Jewish kids are pushed, the way that Asian kids are pushed, or the way that Indian kids are pushed. You know, there's just something about our heritage and our tradition that's very much based on that, needing to be the best. I've always seen life very, I'm extremely competitive. Sometimes it worries me and it's annoying. I get very jealous. I get very envious of people I know, of people I don't know. But it does push me and it motivates me to be the best I can be. So part of it is that. Part of it is it's fun. I like to work. I don't like to take vacations. I don't like to do nothing. I get very antsy when I do. One of my favorite movies of all time is My Dinner with Andre. And there's a great scene toward the end where Wally Shawn talks about this. He can't really sit there and just be. He has to be doing something. Otherwise, he gets very uncomfortable. And I think that there's a philosophical thing there as far as, like, if you're sitting there too long and you're not doing anything, you start to think about life and death. And, you know, to be doing work, to do something, keeps you from, you know, becoming depressed and suicidal, maybe. You just keep going. Like, as long as I'm doing something, I feel useful. And I feel like I'm being, you know, I have some worth. And so that makes me feel better about myself. And it keeps me from getting depressed or sad. You know, I get over problems that I have in my life and emotional issues by working and by writing, as opposed to eating a hamburger or sitting and, you know, feeling sorry for myself. I'd much rather work and produce something. That makes me feel much, much better, because then I have something. Then I'm being useful. I've done something. I keep lists even throughout my day as far as, like, do the laundry or go grocery shopping. It makes me feel like I've accomplished something to do that. I know a lot of other people used to do that too, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, for example, probably for the same reason. One of the reasons I'd like to think, at least theoretically, that I stopped being so meticulous about keeping notes and retyping my notes and all those kinds of things about everything I was experiencing experiencing is because I had a friend who said, who was sort of like a mentor to me. He's a bit older. He told me, I actually asked him, I said, you know, how do you like keep notes, or how do you remember things that are important or that you want to put into your work or whatnot? And he said very clearly, you know, if it's worth remembering, he will.
Hi, my name is Paul Smart, and this is the May edition of The Work Show on WGXC-FM, featuring author Matthew Klickstein this time around. Everybody is in too many pieces.
Thing and whatnot. I mean, I was writing letters to Phyllis Diller when I was like 11, when everyone else again was writing to, you know, Wayne Gretzky or whatever it was. I'm very enamored with the past, as much as it's, I'm just now realizing, ironic too, that we're talking about, like, I'm always pushing forward, but my interests lay very much in the past. And I just don't care about modern politics. I'm extremely disillusioned by it. I actually cared very much about politics when I was younger. I thought I'd be going to politics. I thought I would be maybe a speechwriter.
Any figures that really pulled your interest?
I was really into Richard Nixon as a kid. I think I was rebelling against my mom, who was a very avid and loud-spoken hippie. So I had a rebellion turn, and in so doing, I was sort of a neoconservative as a younger man. I was really into Alex P. Keaton from Family Ties. He was like my hero. You know, a little kind of young Republican, so to speak, which is always really funny to think about. My mom still brings that up a lot. I had a picture of Richard Nixon on the wall when I was younger. Now, of course, I know a lot better. You know, and I think it was a little bit of, like, just to piss Mom off and some of her friends. You know, it sort of delighted me when they would come in and sort of sneer at my Richard Nixon picture on the wall. You know, again, it was rebelling against the rebellion. So I was very reactionary. And I still have a little bit of that in me. I still have a little bit of reactionary neoconservatism. As someone who is extremely contrarian, I can be, you know, I can be pretty outspoken when it comes to neoconservatism in some ways. It can be pretty traditional. And again, I think that goes back to my love of the past and whatnot. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I don't really watch the news. I don't really care about it. I think a lot of it's bullshit. Again, I was very involved in politics when I was younger. I actually worked for a local congressman, and I was, you know, involved in different political groups and whatnot. I even went and took a class the summer between my junior and senior year of high school at Georgetown. And it was actually at the college and everything. We had an actual Georgetown professor teaching the class. I counted as a government class for me senior year of high school. And that was, I think, when I started really realizing that everyone else wanted to be president, and I wanted to be the person who got the president ousted. I wanted to be George Orwell or Aldous Huxley more than the president or even a speechwriter for the president. Also, my experiences working in the field with congressmen and doing different things for the ACLU and things of that nature, again, completely disillusioned me. And I just realized the whole thing was a farce. And as I like to say these days when someone asks, I say, I don't watch that channel. I'm sorry, I see it as sports. I see it as soap opera. I see it, I feel like I'm seeing the strings, and I care more about the strings than I do about the puppets. I'm really not interested in politics. I think it's all the fact that you start finding out that a lot of these people are friends with each other, and they actually sort of work together. It's all nonsense to me, and I just don't really care. I see it as a fad. It would be like following, yeah, a soap opera or following a fashion or something like that. That's why I think I'm more into the past with it, because then you can really see, okay, what really happened. What's really going on? That's why when we're talking about, like, I love that movie Game Change or Recount. During the time, I could give it. But now I'm going back. It's like, okay, let's really deconstruct it now. Let's see what actually happened. And actually, now people actually have had a chance to say what happened, and books have been written. I'm much more interested in that than I am when it's actually happening.
Yeah, there's a growing fascination or focus on inequality in other areas.
Absolutely. I think that's why a lot of the stuff that comes out now is total and complete crap. Because it sort of goes back to what we were talking about before, where it's this very insular, myopic view. I think Dunham, again, is a prime example of that. You know, she makes TV for spoiled little brats, spoiled little 14-year-old girls. And unfortunately, because of the society that we're developing right now, and a lot of the material is made for spoiled little 14-year-old girls, even, you know, men and older guys and older women and that kind of stuff are seeing it as some kind of empowerment or whatever they want to pretend that it is. But, you know, she's really talking about one very small segment of the world, which would be fine. That would be fine. But the problem is so much of it's just that now. So much of the TV and movies and books are coming out about and for people who are rather wealthy and live in New York City or LA, because that's who they are. And again, it's the Bush thing. How could they know what else is going on in the world? They're very much staying in that milieu. If they leave that, they freak out, you know? I think, and again, I think if it's done right, you know, and if there's more of a variety of that, it works a lot better, you know?
Is there a danger of this happening with anything that appears in book form?
Yeah, because one of the only ways you can get your book published is if you happen to live in New York, very much like one of the only ways you can make movies or TV is if you happen to live in LA. I mean, and I know people who spent the last 10 years of their lives in New York or in LA and are now starting to do stuff, and great for them. They paid their dues and they worked really hard and struggled and survived, and that's great. But there's a part of me too where it's like, you know what though, buddy? All you know is about struggling and living in LA, and you never toured around the world, you never toured around the country, and you never, you know, and if they did, it was little trips, you know, on the weekends or with their family. You know, it's another thing to really spend a month or 2 or 3 months or a year or 6 months in Boulder, Colorado, or in Iowa, or in, you know, Europe or whatever it is, and really see what other people are going through, what other people are doing.
What are some of the things that you have found or are finding as you have traveled?
One of them, unfortunately, is how small the world is getting. You know, those friends of mine who toured around the world, they used to say the same thing. They would go to these weird countries in Eastern Europe, you know, and everyone kind of still looked the same, because unfortunately that's one of the many and really big downsides of the internet, is it sort of collapses and destroys cultural heritage. It makes everyone want to seem like and look like American, because let's be honest, the internet is American. The internet is totally 100% American. It's almost all in English. It's almost all very much based on American mentalities. We're the ones who kind of set the standards as far as what can be on there and what can't be on there for the most part, you know, and so and we're the ones really promoting all those kinds of things on the internet. So, you know, even in these small little weird countries, you know, people still all are wearing t-shirts with American bands and American movies and that kind of stuff on it. And I'm definitely seeing that too. It's really disheartening to go to all these weird little places in the middle of nowhere in Iowa or in Omaha, Nebraska, or even outside of Omaha, like smaller cities out there, and to just see the same little mini mart of Subway and McDonald's and Starbucks and the like and Applebee's. And it's like, I want the real mom and pop shop. You know, and so too, I want to hear bands that sound very much like their area rather than just a band that sounds like Dave Matthews or whomever, you know, this homogenized garbage. And so that's definitely one of the first things that I noticed. Even when I was younger and I used to take little road trips on my own around California and Arizona and Nevada and such, I remember, like, realizing, like, God, you just keep seeing the same McDonald's and Starbucks and, you know, what's the point of even traveling anymore? And that's been really sad and really disheartening. And then on another level, all the little kind of cool small towns like Portland, Oregon, and maybe Baltimore and Austin, Texas, and Boulder, Colorado, you know, all have, again, a very similar sort of sensibility and similar kinds of record stores and similar kinds of coffee shops, and, you know, God, I'm blanking on the word right now, but where you can sort of switch them around and they'd be the same, basically.
Yeah. Interchangeable.
They're almost all interchangeable, which I hate to say, and it's sad to say it, but I really do feel that way.
Some of that come from just the way your own interests pull you into certain parts of towns, or is that...
Yes and no. I mean, that's a really good question. I definitely think that I do tend to go to the record stores and to the coffee shops and the bookstores and that kind of thing. But that said, some of these towns really are really, really small, and there's like one main street. And, you know, so it's not just me. It's like there's the main street and then there's all the little, you know, kind of neighborhoods. And a lot of these main streets look and seem very much the same and have a lot of the same kinds of businesses and a lot of the same kinds of mentalities and sensibilities. It's like, every place I go, there's the yoga place, and there's the tea place, and there's the little antique shop, and the little art gallery, and all the art is kind of the same. I'm just not really getting a sense of diversity in the different places I'm going to. It's one of the reasons that I've kind of been kept from going to Europe or Eastern Europe, is I want to kind of keep it a little bit mysterious.
Is it a mass form of gentrification?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a little bit of that going on, and I think some of that's really good, as we were talking about, you know, you and Fawn and I the other day. I think every town needs a little bit of gentrification. You know, I think that that's really cute and, on a hypothetical level, really beautiful and kind of naively utopian to try to say, well, you know, we don't want gentrification because we don't want outsiders and this or that, and that's adorable. But just to kind of wrap this up, because I can go on forever about this, you know, no one wants to live in a ghetto, and no one wants to live in a place where there's crime everywhere, and no one wants to live in a place where their kids can't go out and play and have a good time. Some form of gentrification is good. There are areas of the Bronx, there are areas of different parts of the country where they need, you know, better businesses, they need cleaner streets, they need, you know, houses that aren't falling apart. I mean, let's be perfectly honest, and that's what everybody really wants. They want to be honest. You know, there's sort of that, like, you know, white man's pride thing of you need to keep the cities the way that they are and the blah 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 blah, and that's really patronizing and pathetic. The reality is we need to pump some good businesses and some clean, you know, cleanliness and that kind of stuff into these cities, and I think that they can do it on their own. I'm not saying let's move in Subways and McDonald's and Starbucks, that's what I was saying earlier, but I think that we, you know, every town needs a little bit of gentrification, you know, to make it a place, it's a real neighborhood and real community, and not just, you know.
Well, so, just moving to kind of wrap up and stuff, do you see, I mean, is it a, do you see anything in your movement? I mean, there's all the work that you're doing, there's this constant flow. Do you see it in you finding a place? Or is it something where, you know, are you sort of a constant expatriate?
That's a really good question. I think a good way to wrap it up, maybe. That's something I sort of deal with all the time. I think that goes back to that question of you know, do I settle and find a place that I really love and find a girl that I really love and get the house and do the kids and get the car and commit to, you know, contracts, whether they're personal or financial, and really stick around and have to do that? Or do I, you know, keep looking for that next great adventure? And keep, especially when, you know, do I want to settle before I've really, you know, become stable in my work for art and writing and that kind of thing? Or do I want to be one of those people who says, well, this was great, and like my friends in that band say, you know, it's time to make some real money and time to have a 401k plan and time to have medical insurance and to know that I have, you know, a job, you know, although right now no one's job is stable, let's be honest. But, you know, to have at least more of a semblance of that. So it's a question that I'm constantly asking myself. It's one of the reasons why I'm not speaking right now with my dad. He's had a real difficult time over the last, you know, decade, pretty much since I decided to live this way and be this way. He doesn't really understand why and how I live this way. And it's caused a lot of strife with us, you know, and I think one of the reasons why I am so motivated and one of the reasons why I do want to create some of those really big projects as I have and hope to continue to do, and even projects that are much, much bigger as I hope soon, is to sort of prove to him that this can be done and that I can live this way as I have been, but I can keep doing it, you know, and make him proud in that way. You know, I wish I didn't care, and there's part of me that doesn't want to because he can be a real asshole about it, but, you know, I can't help it. I'm beholden to my dad and to his opinion, and I want him to say, wow, Matt, I get why you're doing this, and I understand, which is something he's really struggled with and maybe will always struggle with. I know that Woody Allen's parents, even toward the end of their lives, still thought Woody should have been an insurance salesman even after he had won all these awards and everything. That might go back to the Jewish thing again. I think that they all want us to be insurance agents or lawyers or doctors or whatever it is, and even when we are successful at our artistic craft. I mean, that's the whole story of the jazz singer, you know, which is the story of a lot of people's lives, George Burns again and some of these other people. So, I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever find a place that I really love, but I hope that I can, and I hope that I do. You know, I would love to find that balance, that medium ground of I have the house, I have the family, I can take trips when I want, I have medical insurance, things are taken care of, and I have my writing office, and I'm making my living writing and doing it. You know, I really hope that that's what I have. I want to have a family, I want to have a house. But I want to be a writer, too, and I want to always be able to write and to be able to make my living writing or doing something artistic or creative.
Where to next?
After this, I'm going back to, I'm going to, you know, keep adventuring a little bit after this. I'm going to New York City for a day to take care of some business and to handle some things I need to handle there. Then I'm actually going to go back to Lawrence, Kansas for a week and spend some time with a new gal pal, so to speak, and see some friends out there. And then I'm going with said gal pal back to New York City so we can spend a week there together. She's never been before. And then I'm actually going to go right back to Lawrence, Kansas again. So wasting a little bit of money and time in the back and forth traveling. But she really wants to see me. I really want to see her. You know, I think that, you know, I like traveling and that kind of thing. And the sort of staying with her afterwards is something we both kind of just decided sort of last minute. I was actually planning originally on coming back to New York and she'd go back to Kansas and I would stay here and continue trying to live in upstate New York, like Hudson or something like that. But, you know, I just think I'd like to give Lawrence, Kansas a try for a summer. And she would actually like to leave Lawrence in a year. And I'm thinking if I stay in Lawrence with her for a year, we can try to kind of develop a relationship, see where it goes. It's going to continue being an adventure one way or another for the next couple of years, probably.
You'll be able to take over the work show on WGXE-FM in Hudson, New York.
Oh, that would be great.
This has been the May edition of The Work Show, featuring author and social critic Matthew Klickstein. Music this time was by the great British working class group of clear Marxist origins, Gang of Four. I am your producer and host, Paul Smart. Until next month, keep on doing whatever you do to make money and keep on working.
When I was in my mother's womb, social structure seemed a simple thing. After birth, I cursed my luck. Then when